This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
Have you noticed that every time I say it, I fling my arm out and like I can't say welcome to Crime Binge without doing that?
Honestly, it adds flair.
Did you even notice it until I pointed it out?
Not really.
Damn.
Honestly, it should be like on our Instagram story, though.
Right. Just the intro. Yeah. I was just suddenly very aware that I was flinging my arm. And I was like, I think I always do this. But that was already a tangent. I'm Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And we're coming at you with episode 38 this week.
Yeah. And again, taking a short break from child murder.
Yes. We still needed some time.
Yeah.
But we're going to do something a little different today. We are each going to tell our favorite I Survived story.
Yeah.
And we're mainly doing this because, one, they survived. So that's a very, like, happy, fun thing. But also, we have a bigger one next week. So we wanted to be able to, like, do something we know.
Yeah.
And then dive deep into a case we don't know as much about. Like, next week's case, I know shit about it, but
there's so much to uncover.
Yeah, there's like, it's really weird. The timeline's weird. Everything's weird. So, you know?
Yeah. And like, again, I know these cases like the back of my hand.
Yeah.
And I love the stories and just like the pure badassness of these women.
Right.
It's insane.
It's very cool. I love it. But what are you binging this week, my friend?
So this week I am binging
immediately forgets what it's called.
I don't remember. Okay, it is Jensen and Holes, the murder squad.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I didn't know if the murder squad came first or second.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I obviously listened to My Favorite Murder.
Yeah.
And they are stemmed from the Exactly Right network.
Mm-hmm.
And I just started listening to them recently because they had like done some updates about them actually getting like solving cases. Basically.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know what it was about. I thought it was just another true crime podcast, just like everything else. And they actually like they do cases that you know and cases that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of every episode, they have like a call to action where it's like, you know, show these pictures to your relatives or do this or do that. Like, and they're trying to get people involved to solve these cases. And for people who don't know, Billy Jensen is a true crime journalist. Mm-hmm. And Paul Holes is a retired cold case investigator. And they worked a little bit together on the Golden State Killer case.
Yeah.
But it's just, you hear, I mean, we're part of it, but you hear the same, like, story covered over and over in the same way, but it's really refreshing to hear the different opinions from
like a professional,
yeah, like a journalist and someone who used to like actually investigate these, because
right.
Billy Jensen will be like, oh, Paul, when you were in the force, like how did you approach this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's really different and I like it a lot.
Yeah, that's cool. I still haven't listened to it either and I've been meaning to give it a shot, but I am just, like, still bogged down in Critical Role land.
Yeah. Well, I have a feeling that's not your binge this week, so what are you binging?
I mean, technically, it should be, like, my
sub-binge
every week, but this week, I'm binging the Explained series on Netflix.
Okay.
And it takes a topic and does basically like a little like 20 to 30 minute history slash documentary lesson on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have like The Mind Explained and Sex Explained, which I haven't gotten into yet, but I've heard really good things about it. But like the first one we watched, obviously, was Cults, because you know me. But the second one we watched was Pirates. And you learn a lot of cool stuff, like one of the Nazis who was like under Hitler but was still a really big player.
Okay.
He was charged with piracy after the war. And apparently it's because piracy is like an act against like mankind.
Okay.
And so he was charged with piracy because he like did this horrible act against mankind. Oh. And it's really interesting because I love history and yeah. you get to find out a lot of cool stuff. The most recent one we watched was like tattoos mm-hmm. and it gives the history behind tattoos and like how they're going now. And it's just very cool, very fun.
Yeah. Actually, Corey messaged me today saying that he started a new series on Netflix called Broken. Mm. And it's about like the behind the scenes of different industries. Like he said that the first two episodes were makeup industry.
Yeah.
And, like vaping.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
And so I was like, ooh, I'm going to have to watch that. It sounds really cool.
Yeah. You should also check out Explained. It's really yeah. fun. And each episode is like narrated by a famous person.
Okay.
So, and you'll like, you'll hear the voice and you're like, fuck, I know who that is. And then you have to like go look up who it is, even though they'll tell you the narrator in like 2 seconds if you're just patient, but I'm not. But it's really fun. I like it. And it's like a little history lesson every night that's only 20 minutes long.
Yeah. I like things that are shorter like that, that you can just yeah. listen to really quickly.
And I do like at the end of it, find myself being like, wow, I wish that was just a little longer so okay. I could like learn more stuff. So it's like it goes by really quick, but you're learning stuff. And I thought it was really fun.
Nice. That is very cool.
But should we get into today's story?
Yeah. Morgan is going to start and tell us her I Survived story.
I am.
Well, not her personal one, but
I survived
life
being a teen. I don't know. So obviously the main source from today is I Survived. Mm-hmm. It's in season 1, episode 11. And it's also with, because they do like 3 people usually yes. per episode. And it's also with a man who like got his arms stuck in farm equipment. And like, yeah, the whole thing. Or I think it might have just been his hand, but I can't remember because I mm-hmm. am the worst. And then the like third one was a fucking like school attack where an intruder came in with a machete.
Oh, wow.
And like the principal fought him off type thing. And when I was watching I Survived, it like immediately drew me back to my childhood when I would watch this show with my mom. And I remember in episodes like that, I would be like, what if my arm gets torn off? And my mom was like, you don't live on a farm, Morgan. Why would your arm be torn off by farming equipment? I'm like, Mom, what if my arm gets torn off by farming equipment?
You never know when like a tractor is going to be yeah, right there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it could happen at any time. So I used to freak myself the fuck out with I Survived and all of the scenarios. I was like, what if that happened to me? So it was kind of like a blast from the past to rewatch this episode.
Yeah.
And then obviously I think like the source that made this story the most popular, I would say, mm-hmm. is My Favorite Murder.
Yeah.
They covered the case in episode 33 and then in mm-hmm. episode 95, it is a live show. Jennifer Morey, who is who I'm covering today. I'd never said that, did I?
Nope.
Yep. Jennifer Morey, like, comes on stage and she's in the audience while they're performing. And I cried so hard when I heard that episode. So I am covering that because it's really stuck with me ever since. And I do actually remember watching this episode when I was younger because I recognized her face, but
okay, yeah,
I didn't remember fully what the story was. So we are just gonna jump right into Jennifer Morey's story.
Yeah, tell me her Morey story. I'm sorry, that was lame as fuck.
It wasn't good, but you made an attempt and I appreciate that. So also, basically, this is like gonna be me plagiarizing the I Survived episode because I just like sat there and typed everything she said because she's like such a powerful person that I was like,
yeah, I did so many quotes.
Yeah. So in April of 2000, Jennifer had recently moved to Houston, Texas. And before she moved there, she went up for a weekend searching for the safest apartment complexes as she would be living alone, which is like a really smart thing to do. Yeah,
which I did not do in mine.
And she was also like a lawyer at this time. So she also knew like you got to keep yourself safe.
Yeah.
like, especially when you're a lawyer, you need to have like a safe place to live because people do come for you sometimes. Mm-hmm. So she thought she lucked out when she found the bayou, right? That's how you say that. She thought she lucked out when she found the Bayou Park Apartments on Memorial Drive. And these were great because they were close to downtown. They had a huge fence around the entire perimeter of the property. It was like 8 feet tall. And Jennifer was also living on the second floor, which I don't remember this fact that she was living on the second floor when I was watching the episode.
Really?
And that fucked me up so badly because I've always been like, I will not live on the first floor of an apartment complex because that's when bad things happen to you. But like, this is the second floor and bad shit can still happen to you.
Yeah. Like, I live on the first floor.
I know. And it freaks me out.
It is scary. I do luckily have so many more options to get out of my apartment if I need to. Like, more windows. I can just, I'll be on the ground. Right. I have a porch door and a front door. But like, yeah, it is sketchy and I do my like extra security locks every night.
So yeah, that definitely freaked me out because I was like, now I'm going to be attacked on the second floor because you know me, I'm the worst. The other night I told Sarah someone broke into my house because I went out and my car windows were down and I didn't do it. I'm dramatic.
It's okay. It was scary.
It was scary, and I'm still thinking about it. I know it was just a malfunction, but I'm still freaked out. Or it was a ghost.
That
too. I don't know. I don't know.
Which would you prefer?
Honestly, like, prefer a ghost or a malfunction?
Or someone breaking into your house.
A ghost. 100%. The fact that someone would be in my house and I didn't know it is the worst.
Yes.
Blech. So, Jesus Christ, I am on a tangent today. After Jennifer had settled in, she had been there for a few days. On the night of April 15th, around 10 p.m., a friend called and told her that she wanted to go out to the alehouse, and Jennifer joined her. She wanted to have a night out. While she was out, a man there offered her a ride home, and she accepted. And she was dropped off at around 1 a.m., not 1 p.m. That would be
an awkward date.
She got into her apartment and did all of the normal things, getting ready for bed. She locked her deadbolt, washed her face, and got into bed.
Yeah, I bet she was like me, like, I'll be laying in bed and be like, I know I locked the door, but like, did I lock the door?
Yeah.
And I'll get up and check.
You always got to. Around 4 a.m., Jennifer wakes up out of a dead sleep and feels someone on top of her as she starts to wake up. And in the episode, she's talking about, like, how she was in such a deep sleep that, like, she was really groggy waking up and, like, didn't really fully comprehend what was happening to her. So she could tell that there was someone grabbing at her underwear, trying to take them off. And during the show, she says that she could vividly remember the way that the man's leg hairs felt against her.
I literally just got goosebumps.
Right? Like, when she said that, I was like, you don't think about those things staying with you. But yeah, they were coarse hairs, by the way.
Them hairs were coarse.
She reached up and felt a knife against her throat, and this is when she suddenly realized that, like, the man was there to hurt her and he was trying to rape her. And she kept saying over and over again that she was like, I cannot be raped. Like, I will not let this happen. And
good on her.
What am I saying?
I wouldn't do
Spoiler.
That.
Spoiler. She didn't. But she immediately starts fighting back, screaming, kicking, and, like, trying to push this knife away. And this really pissed off the man, so this is when he started to, like, actually physically attack her. He hit her in the head, and at one point she thought that he had just, like, cut her eye out because of how much blood was there, and it was, like, filling her eyes so she couldn't see. And what he had actually done is slashed her forehead, like, over her eye. Eyebrow. And this part pissed me off so badly that she was screaming so loudly that 20 people in 15 different apartments near her heard her screams and not a single one called the police.
It's just like Kitty Genevieve.
Yeah, I know, but it's just like,
this was the year 2000.
Yeah,
like,
call someone, please.
Yeah, even the non-emergency number.
Yeah, and just be like, there's, I think, a domestic happening. Like, something like that.
Yeah, something bad is happening.
Yeah. No one screams like that for a reason. Like, for no one's, for no reason, you know? So he told her to shut up, and he kept telling, like, he kept saying her name. He kept saying, Jennifer, shut the hell up, and just kept, like, yelling that at her, which that made her realize immediately that she knew who he was, but she couldn't place the voice.
Yeah.
Which would be, like, a horrible feeling, like, to suddenly realize you know this person in some way, which it happens a lot. Like, most rapes actually occur from someone you know, which is unfortunate. At this point, the man was so angry that he slashed her throat. And it started from her right ear and moved all the way down, several inches down her neck. When this happened, she knew she was in trouble. Previously, she had thought that she could just maybe persuade him to let her go when this happened. Let her go. But then when he cut her neck, she was like, oh, shit. No, this is serious. He will kill me if I don't get out of this. I think because I'm talking so much, like,
you're not really looking at your
notes. And I'm like getting really jumbled in my head. And at this point, she's talking a lot in the episode about how she's a very logical person and knew that she should be collecting as much evidence as possible. But she couldn't bring herself to do these things because she didn't want to anger him even more by, like, looking around and shit. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, she's a lawyer. So she is, like, very logically, like, I need this for my case, but she can't bring herself to do it. So in an attempt to save her life, she kept trying to assure him that she wouldn't look at him to save her.
Yeah.
And he eventually ends up dragging her to the bathroom and then, like, returns to the room to get his knife, which to me is just the dumbest fucking thing. Like
he probably thought she was too weak.
Probably. But it's just, it's a weird thing to, like, leave your victim alone when you're trying to attack them.
Yeah.
It just felt weird. So when she was in the bathroom, she slammed the door shut. Guess what? This door doesn't have a fucking lock on it.
How does your bathroom door not have a lock?
Right? Like, all of the odds are against Jennifer. Yeah. The door didn't have a lock, so she braced herself, like, against the tub to make sure he couldn't break it open. And at one point, she said that, like, her legs hurt so bad. They were, like, trembling from, like, pushing. And then when she does this, she realizes that her apartment is suddenly very quiet, like, eerily quiet, and she could hear him, like, lightly moving around in her apartment and then heard him zip up his pants.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you imagine?
Yeah. It's just like, is it over or?
It's such a menacing zip. Like, that would be the most menacing zip of your life. She grabbed a roll of toilet paper and put it against her neck to try and slow the bleeding. She knew that she had to get out of the bathroom soon or she was going to bleed to death. Like we said.
Yeah, because, like, that's your, from your ear down your neck, that's your carotid artery.
Yeah.
And, like,
yeah, she, it was, like, right up, like, her jugular. Like, it was very close to her jugular. And she does the next bravest thing, because I also wouldn't be able to do this. Mm-hmm. She knew that she had to get out of the bathroom, so she opened the door to come out.
Nope.
Like, can you imagine? I would literally just, like, bleed out in the bathroom, honestly, because I would be so horrified. When I'm home alone and I hear a noise in the apartment, I don't come out for, like, 10 fucking minutes. And I know those are low stakes, so... Mm-hmm. Very impressive stuff from Jennifer. Her hands were so covered in blood, and she had pushed the door so hard that she actually couldn't get the bathroom door open at first and had to struggle with it for, like, a while to try and get it open.
Which, like, I feel like that would be scarier for me just because you're like, now I'm stuck.
Yeah, exactly. Like, everything is just building on top of it, and it's just, it's crazy to me. But eventually, she is able to jerk this door open, and she calls out to see if he's still there, and no one calls back. And she's like, I don't know why I did it, but I did. And
I just imagine her just being like, hello.
Yeah, she did say hello, which is funny, but I'm sure she didn't do like, hello, yeah, in an accent.
It would be more like, hello.
Yeah. So she gets out of the bathroom and she is like stumbling around trying to turn on the lights in her place, but her power has been cut. And then she goes to her phone and the power line to her phone has also been cut.
And this was when people had landlines.
Yeah. And she sits on the couch to like take a second to herself and then suddenly becomes like overwhelmed with this panicked idea that he's in the apartment with her still. Which is understandable because I would be doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully, she finds her cell phone and calls the police. And the operator, Richard Beckett, was like really just the nicest operator and was able to actually calm her down. And they play some of the 911 call in the episode.
Oh, yeah.
And she's like telling him what happened and like really, really freaking out. And just like in a couple of sentences, like she's calmed down. She's like, okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to breathe now. And he's like, good job. Like, breathe. It's really like, it's, yeah, really sweet because that would be a horrifying situation. And Richard Beckett is the man. We're going to get into why he's the man, but he's the man.
A medal. Because like you hear like really bad 911 calls with terrible operators.
Yeah.
And then like every once in a while there's a fucking gem in there. And yeah. Like,
and then there's like just that really, really good one.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you typically remain on the line with the operator until the police arrive. So she's still on the phone with Richard, who is asking her if she had been cut anywhere else and instructs her on things to do to stop the bleeding. Typical 911 operator stuff. While they are on the phone, though, about 15 minutes later, there's a pounding at her door. And Jennifer tells the operator, and he goes, don't open that door. That's not the police. And she begins calling out to, like, see who it is, and the man responds that he's security. The voice on the other side was promising her help and was very insistent that she open the door immediately. The operator tells her, do not open the door if she doesn't know who it is, as he had a bad feeling about it. The police at this point had not notified security on site about the attack.
Mm-hmm.
So why would security know? The man continues knocking and aggressively asks her to be let in because he wants to help her, Sarah. He just wants to help.
Yeah. I mean, how does he know what he needs to help with? But he, yeah, needs to help.
Yeah, for sure. Richard tells her that it'll be okay. Don't let the man in and you will be safe. And at this point, she has a very large slash across her eyebrow, one going down from her cheek to her jugular vein. And she had been stabbed through her throat and had two stab wounds in her arms. And she's like still up and talking, mm-hmm, to this Richard man. And at this point, I just put in this little note that they talk about her feeling guilty about the attack. Because she was like wondering if it was her fault that she was being attacked, but she was also really worried what her mom would do if she died. Like, she just kept thinking over and over again, like, my mom's not going to be okay if I leave. And it was just like really sad, yeah, but I liked that they had her talk about it, because that's real. Like, that, yeah, shit happens after you're attacked, that you have those kind of feelings. And I liked that they like included that, mm-hmm, portion of it. So the police eventually arrive at her apartment and she confirms with Richard that the voices that she hears are police and she lets them in. The first thing that she heard when she's like going kind of in and out at this point was that there was a security guard who had also been injured. And she started crying because someone else got hurt and she was like, it's my fault that someone, yeah, else got hurt. The Pinkerton security guard who was injured was Brian Gibson. He had a cut on his right hand and he told police that he was attacked when the intruder jumped from her second story balcony and tried to run away. He said that he was able to wrestle the intruder before the intruder fled to a nearby field. The police found this very strange and began searching the crime scene. The field showed no signs of footprints or the struggle that Gibson had said occurred. In the apartment, they start searching around after Jennifer's been taken to the hospital and stuff, and they found a man's underwear covered in blood, a Pinkerton security cap, a belt, a glove, and a knife. Which, like, just leave all your shit behind, right? I guess.
I mean, the only thing he did was fucking zip up his pants.
Yeah, like, this guy.
And, like, I don't know. It's just, like, crazy that he knew she was still alive even after he left.
That's true, yeah. He probably just, like, heard her on the phone or something.
That's true.
But the police take Gibson in for questioning, and they asked him to remove his boots because they were getting him into, like, prison clothing, yes, basically. So they had him remove his boots, and he had on white socks that were spattered in blood. They took off his shirt and he had blood on his stomach, and then they took off his pants and he didn't have any underwear on.
I wonder where they were.
Yeah. He also didn't have his Pinkerton security hat on, and the police find it very likely, and so does Jennifer, that he was not there to help Jennifer, but was in fact returning to get his belongings and kill her.
Yeah.
When she was in the hospital, some of the detectives on the case came into her room and told her that she put up a hell of a fight, which, like, made me tear up a little bit, mm-hmm, because it's, well, kind of gross because they were talking about the blood splatter in the apartment, yeah, and they were like, there was so much of it that we could tell you put up a fight, but it was just, like, cool that the police were, like, talking with her that, and, like, yeah. I just thought that was nice. Brian Gibson went to trial and was convicted of aggravated burglary with intent to commit sexual assault and was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Jennifer felt that he should never have been allowed to be employed by Pinkerton, and during his 3 years of employment with the company, he received numerous complaints and had a criminal record. Jennifer filed a lawsuit after researching this and found out that it wasn't the first time the Pinkerton security guard had hired hired guards with felonies. Records show that between 1991 and 1995, there were 130 guards hired that had felonies.
That is insane.
Yeah. And, like, that's not to say that if anyone ever gets a felony, they shouldn't get a job again, but you shouldn't be have a job as a security guard, especially if your previous crimes were violent crimes.
Yeah.
Like, that just makes sense. It's crazy. Obviously, after her attack, she didn't feel super comfortable living in that apartment anymore. So 2 weeks later, she moved out and she moved in with her mom, who rarely left her side at this point.
Which is so nice.
Yeah. Jennifer describes this time period as feeling paranoid and afraid of everything. Eventually, she recovered from her traumatic ordeal as much as she could and became a successful lawyer with her own practice. She also eventually met someone and got married a few years after her attack, and Richard Beckett, the dispatcher who helped her, had become a close friend and even attended the wedding, which is just, like, the nicest thing I've ever heard.
It is. I love, like, hearing these stories and, like, how these women can get their life back afterwards.
Yeah.
And,
like take control, yeah, do something meaningful, and, like, be strong as fuck.
Yeah.
Like, even if you don't become a lawyer or, like, create a foundation, like, you're still strong as fuck. It's just really cool to, like, see it.
It really is.
Yeah. But that was Jennifer Morey, who's now Jennifer Morey Caldwell.
I love these episodes. I love I Survived.
Claps for myself. Yeah, I Survived are just, like, so heartwarming.
They are.
Because it's terrible, terrible shit that's happening, but, like, they're able to, like, fucking kick ass and take names.
Mm-hmm. So, Now it's my turn. And I'm happy because Morgan let me do this one. And it is my favorite story.
Sarah has been wanting to do this for a while.
Yeah. So I am doing the story of Mary Vincent. And again, I watched the I Survived, which was season 3, episode 1. And also got a bunch of stuff from other sources, including the My Favorite Murder episode where Karen did her story in episode 18 mm-hmm. and Morbid did it in episode 27 and some articles and stuff.
Yeah.
So starting off a little bit about Mary Vincent. She was one of 7 children and she was raised in a military family and her parents were strict.
Mm-hmm.
And she was raised in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Fun.
She was an okay student, but she was an excellent dancer and had a promising career in the future with dance. She had worked front stage at the Lido de Paris in Las Vegas, and she'd also performed in Hawaii and Australia. And, like, that was her dream.
Yeah.
That was like, what she was going to do.
To become a professional dancer.
Mm-hmm. And as a teen, she started kind of becoming rebellious. She would cut class and she ran away a couple times and, like, oh my god, she wore makeup.
Oh shit. Oh, she's no. a rebel.
Yeah. But she did, like, even spend one summer living with her boyfriend in his car and, like, would spend some nights sleeping on her uncle's couch and a bunch of shit happened with that.
Yeah. She's like what I thought I was doing when I was a rebellious teen, but wasn't doing at all. I was just like pouting because my phone got taken away.
For real. So her parents were in the middle of a divorce and Mary was like, I need a break from this. And she decided she was going to run away and hitchhike her way to California to her grandparents' house in Los Angeles. And I also heard other accounts that on the day she ran away,
mm-hmm.
her father was coming home with a migraine and was angry at her, and she said that, like, she had to run away to save her life because he was kind of abusive.
Okay.
And it was on September 29th, 1978, when Mary ran away, and she was 15 years old.
I forgot how young she was. Mm-hmm.
She's just a baby. So she was hitchhiking, and on the side of the road, there were 2 other hitchhikers, and they're all just holding their signs saying where they wanted to go. Hers said south. And this blue van pulls up. And the man driving the van only offers Mary a ride, saying he only had room for her in this big-ass empty van. Because you could see in the windows and there was nothing else.
Right.
And even though all of the other hitchhiker or the 2 other hitchhikers, like, had signs saying they were all going in the same direction.
Yeah.
And the other hitchhikers found this unsettling and were trying to get Mary to not go with him. And they were like, we can wait for another car or whatever. But Mary was honestly, like, she was so tired and she was ready to leave that she just got in the van.
Yeah. And honestly, though, like, good on those hitchhikers for, like, standing up for their fellow mm-hmm. hitchhiker friend, because they didn't know her before that.
Exactly. And in her I Survived episode, Mary states, I wasn't a daredevil or anything. I was just desperate to get home. I could not live another day out alone. I didn't think about what type of person he was or the situation. I was tired.
And she's also 15, and at 15, you don't think anything bad is ever going to happen to you.
Exactly. You're invincible.
Yeah.
So the man who picked up Mary was a man named Lawrence Singleton. Singleton was 51 years old and was born in Tampa, Florida.
Because of course he was.
Right. So he worked as a merchant seaman and had been divorced twice, and he had a daughter who he didn't have a good relationship with. And she was also 15 at the time. He also had a serious drinking problem. But he was described as being like a grandfatherly type looking man.
Mm-hmm.
He was wearing blue overalls. He had like a big beer belly. And he had like a large bulbous nose. His nose is gross. And again, Mary said that he looked like he could be her grandfather and didn't really feel uneasy when getting in the van, especially when he told her that his own daughter was also 15. So Singleton had actually been on his way to Reno, but offered to get her to Interstate 5, which was clearly out of his way. Another red flag. So the beginning of the ride was pretty uneventful, but at one point, Mary lit a cigarette and sneezed. And, like, Singleton immediately grabbed her and, like, pulled her in close to him and felt her neck to see if she was sick.
That's weird.
And it's like, don't touch me.
Yeah, don't touch people you don't know.
Yeah. And so, like, this weirded Mary out. And she, like, pulled away from him and sat, like, leaning against the door of the car to try and be as far away from him as possible. And I also heard this in only, like, one or two accounts. But apparently on the way, they stopped at his house in San Francisco.
Interesting.
And, like, she helped him carry, like, loads of laundry into his van. And then they went back on the road.
Interesting.
And after driving for a bit, Mary fell asleep as she was hella tired.
Yeah.
And Singleton began drinking liquor out of a milk carton.
Yeah, that's super gross.
Like, weird flex, but okay. Like, and it was, we were unsure of what kind of liquor or what the fuck it was.
It was probably like liquor he made.
Probably.
Like moonshine.
Toilet wine, yeah. Yeah. So after a little bit, Mary wakes up. And she realized that they're not going the right way. And instead of heading south towards LA, they were going east. There was a, like, a surveyor stick on the ground and of the van. And Mary grabbed it and, like, pointed it at Singleton confronting him. And was like, why the fuck are we going the wrong way?
Nice.
And, you know, he apologized, claimed he made an honest mistake, and was like, I'll turn around right now. So at this point, the sun is setting and it's getting dark out.
Right.
After driving for a little bit longer, Singleton pulls over the van saying he had to relieve himself. Mary decided that she was going to step out of the van and stretch her legs a bit, and she noticed that one of her shoes were untied.
Right.
At this time, she was kind of hesitant about the whole situation still.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, if I need to run from him, I need to tie my shoe. And she said, quote, because I was young and healthy and he was old and not.
Yeah.
So she was like, I can outrun him. I just have to make sure I'm prepared.
Yeah.
So she bends over to tie her shoe. And this is when Singleton quietly creeps up behind her and he hits her over the head with a sledgehammer. Yeah.
Like, I know where this story's going, just like you knew where mine is going, but it's still just like,
it's so hard
when you're listening to it.
He then yelled at her, don't scream or I'll kill you. And she went unconscious. So he threw her body into the back of the van. And when she regained consciousness, she was naked and her hands were tied behind her back.
Yeah.
Again, she's 15.
Yeah.
So he forced her to perform fellatio on him before raping and sodomizing her. And after the initial attack, Singleton, like, moved his van down more into the canyon they were next to be off the main road.
Okay.
And then he continuously raped her, like, 6 to 8 more times.
Yeah.
And then started forcing her to drink the liquor out of the milk carton as well. When she asked him why he was doing this, she got no response. And during this time, Mary, like, passed out a couple times. She was in and out of consciousness. You know, she got hit in the head with a fucking sledgehammer.
Yeah, that's pretty fucking intense.
Singleton, though, had also fallen asleep through this process. And, like, as she was still tied up, Mary couldn't get away. And she was like, I'm just fucking sitting here and can't do anything. And she's conscious again. The sun is starting to rise. And he forces her out of the van and makes her lay on the ground. She begs Singleton for her life. And she remembers saying, "Just set me free. Please, just set me free. I won't tell." So, while pulling a hatchet out of the toolbox in the back of his van, he said to her, quote, "You want to be set free? I'll set you free." And while kicking and screaming the whole time, hoping that someone would hear her, Singleton took the hatchet and began swinging the hatchet at her left arm. She began falling, so she grabbed onto him tight with her right arm, and when she looked down, her left arm was gone, and it was severed below the elbow. And this, it took only, like, two swings.
Yeah.
And another quote from I Survived from her, she said, "I felt all the pain, the sharpness, the burning, and when my blood was leaking out of my body, I felt the hot ooze just flowing out of me. I felt everything. I was aware of everything, and the pain was so excruciating." Which, like, I get my blood drawn and I pass out.
Yeah.
Like,
it's also interesting because so many people are like, "You're just going to go into shock. You won't feel any of the pain." Mm-hmm. But, like, she felt everything that was happening to her.
So even throughout her getting her arm cut off, she's still screaming and kicking and fighting.
Because she's fucking a badass bitch.
Yeah. And he began chopping at her right arm. And because she was fighting, it took him much longer to sever this arm. Once Mary's right arm was cut off, Mary fell to the ground because she was holding him to keep herself up.
Right.
And when she fell to the ground, she noticed that Singleton was, like, flicking his arm back and forth. And she realized that her right hand that she had been clutching onto him with was still attached to his arm.
Which, like, just sounds so cartoonish.
It does.
Like, it just sounds like it would be in a movie.
It's, like, sounds so fake, but...
Yeah.
Like... It was just fucking stuck there. And once he got her arm off, he started dragging her body, like, thinking that she was dead because she was like, "I need to lay still."
Yeah.
And was alive the whole fucking time. And he gets to the side of this cliff and he throws Mary off of a 30-foot cliff into a cement culvert, which is, like, a thing that collects water.
Yeah.
Off of Interstate 5. So they were on Interstate 5 in Del Puerto Canyon, California. The fall broke four of Mary's ribs. And that was it.
Which is incredible.
Yeah. And the blood loss sent Mary's body into shock. She laid on the ground, still not knowing if he had driven away or... if he was watching her to make sure she was dead. But in reality, he had driven away thinking that no one would ever find her body.
Yeah.
She's at the bottom of a fucking canyon.
Yeah.
So at this point, Mary begins feeling very tired and very cold. And all she wanted to do was go to sleep. But she heard a voice inside of her saying that if she doesn't survive this, he'll do it again to somebody else.
Right.
And... in her badass soul, she just couldn't let that happen, and she managed to stay awake. And then, being the smartest woman alive, Mary stuck her arms in the dirt, packing the mud around her wounds in order to help stop the bleeding.
Which, like, I would never think to do because I would be like, it's going to get infected.
Yeah, exactly. You know? So she then spent all day. Like, he pushed her off the cliff in the morning.
Yeah.
She spent all day climbing back up, and it was nighttime by the time she got, like, to the top.
Yeah, she's fucking bleeding out, basically.
Mm-hmm. And on this road, there were no streetlights or anything, so she could only see by the light of the moon. When reaching the top of the cliff, she could hear the noise of traffic in the distance. So she kept listening for the noise in order to guide her way back to the road. And she walked throughout the night until the sun started rising again. She walked with her arms straight up in the air in order to keep the blood and muscles from falling out.
That's so graphic.
Mm-hmm. After walking about 3 miles, Mary finally sees a car driving by. It was a red convertible with 2 men inside. And she screamed for help. The car slowed down. They took a fucking look at her and drove away.
Yeah.
And Mary said that, honestly, she couldn't blame them because she looked like something, quote, out of a Fright Night movie, with being naked, having no arms, and covered head to toe in blood and dirt.
Yeah, that would be a horrifying thing to drive up on.
Mm-hmm. And once they drove away, Mary thought she was going to die. Like, she made it this far.
Yeah.
And people are going to be too afraid to stop and help her. She continued walking down the middle of the road, though, hoping for another car to pass. I also want to take this time to remind everyone for the third time that she's only 15 years old.
I don't think this is the third time, but I think it might be like the fifth time.
It's fine. She's only 15 years old.
Yes.
So after a while, another vehicle drives up, and this time it was a truck that had a couple who were on their honeymoon and had gotten lost. And they stopped and tried to help Mary. And the only thing that Mary could say to them was, "He raped me." They put her in the back of the pickup truck and they wrapped her in like all the blankets that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And they started driving, and they drove as fast as they could until they reached the nearest phone, which was at an airport. And the couple called 911. So a rescue helicopter came for Mary and flew her straight to the hospital. She ended up losing over half of the blood in her body, and the remaining blood was at a toxic level.
Yeah.
The people at the hospital had to take pieces of her leg to save what remained of her arm, and this left her unable to ever dance again. But while at the hospital, the police sent over a sketch artist, and Mary was able to describe Singleton so fucking clearly that when the sketch of him appeared on the news, Singleton's next door neighbor, who was also his friend,
yeah,
recognized him immediately and called the cops and was like, "Yeah, that is 100% him."
Yeah, good.
And Singleton gets arrested and claims that Mary was just a prostitute, that she threatened him, and he called her a $10 a night whore.
That's real nice, buddy.
Yeah. He also claimed, in like a separate story, that there was someone else in the van with them, which was one of the, quote, other hitchhikers, and that this other guy was the person who attacked Mary.
And he just like casually carried around,
right?
What was it, a machete?
A hatchet.
Hatchet.
Mm-hmm.
Just casually carried a hatchet to
cut
off someone's arms with.
And he also said that this person's name was also Larry. So if she says it was Larry who attacked her, it was the other Larry.
Very coincidental, Larry.
Right? So then he has his trial, which was in March of 1979, which was just 6 months after the attack. Which I like that about like the 70s is they had their trials right away.
Yeah, like we're doing it now.
And like nowadays it's like, 3 years later, let's have your trial.
Which I mean, like, you have a right to a speedy trial.
Exactly.
It's very interesting.
So Mary had the balls to sit at the witness stand and tell her story to the grand jury. And she said about the time when she was in court, "I was scared because he was just a few feet from me when I was in the witness stand." And after testifying, Mary like straight off left the courtroom. She didn't want to hear anymore.
Right.
And in order to leave the courtroom, she had to pass him. And she was literally just inches away from him. And he whispered to her, "If it's the last thing I do, I will finish the job."
What a piece of shit.
Honestly, like, he just keeps fucking with her.
Yeah.
And Singleton, thank God, was found guilty, but was only sentenced to 14 years in prison for this.
Yeah.
For this rape and attempted murder, which was the longest that he could be sentenced at that time in California. But the judge did say to him, if I had the power, I would send him to prison for the rest of his natural life.
Yeah, like any sane person would.
Exactly. Another fucked up thing.
Yeah.
Is that Mary filed and won a civil suit against Singleton for $2.56 million. And then Singleton revealed that he only had $200 to his name and he was unemployed. So that's literally all she got.
Yeah. Yeah, it's bullshit.
Yeah. Then, it's like the bullshit just keeps happening.
Yeah.
Singleton only serves 8 years and 4 months of his 14-year prison sentence because he was released on good behavior. Who knows why the fuck he was released? Because shortly before, his psychiatric evaluation read, quote, because he is so out of touch with his hostility and anger, he remains an elevated threat to others' safety inside and outside prison.
Yeah, like why the fuck would we release that person?
For real. When he was released, he was chased out of multiple towns.
Good.
And people, like, protested and all of the places he was going to be released to because it's public record.
Right.
And, like, they would call their mayor and their mayor would tell the prison, he's not coming to my town.
Yeah.
And so for, like, the first year of his being on parole, he had to live on a trailer on the grounds of the prison being watched by security so people didn't come attack him.
He definitely honestly deserved that.
Oh, 100%.
Since he didn't finish out his sentence, he deserved that.
So this, like, happened for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically couldn't go to California. And so he secretly moves back to Tampa, Florida. In 1990, he had two more convictions on him. The first one for stealing a $10 disposable camera, where he spent 60 days in jail.
Fun.
And the next one where he stole a $3 hat, and he served 2 years for that.
Nice.
7 years later, in the spring of 1997, a Tampa man called police when he saw a nude Singleton through the window of a house, swinging his arm up and down on top of a woman who was covered in blood.
Cool.
Yep.
Just doing that with the windows open?
Yep.
Okay.
So when the police arrived, they found Singleton covered in blood and the body of Roxanne Hayes, who was a 31-year-old mother of three, who Singleton had paid $20 to have sex with because she was a sex worker. And he killed her by stabbing her over a dozen times with a boning knife. During this trial, Mary Vincent flew to Florida because she felt that she needed to testify and tell the court her story and Singleton's past.
Yeah.
And, like, she kind of said that, like, she felt guilty about this.
Right.
That, like, it happened to someone else, but
it wasn't her fault. Yeah,
yeah, it was the fucking shortcomings of the law.
Yeah, like, he definitely should have been in prison for the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. So after this, since he actually killed someone and Florida's a lot more tough.
Yeah.
he was sentenced to death, but in 2001, he died in prison of cancer. So after her traumatic experience, Mary was depressed and scared for years. She moved multiple times and hired bodyguards.
Yeah,
and everything.
I'm sure the only thing she was replaying is hearing him say, if it's the last thing I'll do, I'll come for you. Mm-hmm. Like, and he's out of prison. I would probably do the same thing.
Oh, yeah. And like she said that when he died, she, like, she wanted to look him in the eyes and ask him why. But, like, since he wasn't executed and died, of cancer.
Yeah.
Like, she didn't get that, so she felt like she didn't really have the closure that she wanted. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's understandable.
But she did eventually get married and have two sons. And she says that her sons helped her get her through this time and, like, ultimately pulled her out of her depression.
That's nice.
And even though she can't dance anymore, she uses her prosthetic arms to do art. And that's something that she found a love in doing. She's also now an advocate for other victims, is a national symbol for the shortcomings within the justice system, and she also helped enact a law called Singleton's Bill that would prevent the early release of offenders that commit a crime in which torture is involved and carries a 25 to life sentence.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so she definitely, like, there's a silver lining.
Yeah, she was able to make some changes that definitely needed to be there.
Yeah.
Because that's crazy.
It
to
is.
To literally cut off a woman's, like, both of her arms and rape her.
Yeah.
Like, that's just...
Like, I feel like attempted murder shouldn't have such a different sentence from murder.
Especially because, to that degree.
Yeah, especially, like, with torture or heinous acts. Like, your intention was for them to die. Whether they died or not, that was your intention right then and there. Like, just because they did or didn't die doesn't change your intention and the way that you committed the crime.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, even though she has, like, now lived a life that she is probably proud of and can look at and stuff, like, she could have had a different life that she was proud of in a different way if it wasn't for him.
Exactly.
So it's just, like, you've ruined someone's life regardless of killing them or not.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're a terrible person.
Yeah, there was a quote from when she went to Florida to testify where, like, she said, I don't have it written down, so I'm remembering it. She said something along the lines of, like, I'm not surprised that he killed someone because he took my life away 19 years ago.
Yeah.
Which was, like, powerful. But those were our, I survived.
And yeah.
Even though it was tragic.
Yeah.
They both, you know, ended up having happy lives.
Which is always something nice to be able to look at when we're, like, full of just horrible murders all the time. Like,
exactly.
It's nice to see something that isn't like that.
Give me a Florida man.
Here is my Florida man. Florida man arrested after refusing to remove I eat ass sticker from truck.
I eat ass?
I eat ass.
But why would he... I don't get it.
I'll read it to you. A Florida man says his First Amendment rights were violated after being arrested for a sticker he placed on his pickup truck. 23-year-old Dylan Shane Webb was pulled over on U.S. Highway 90 after a deputy saw the sticker, which reads, I eat ass. I'm sorry. According to the deputy, the sticker violates Florida statute 847.011, which deals with possession and distribution of obscene material. After confronting Webb, the Florida man told him they were just words. He was issued a notice to appear in court and then took a photo of the sticker. The deputy then asked Webb to remove the ass portion of the sticker. When Florida man refused, the deputy arrested him. He was charged with obscene riding on vehicles and resisting an officer without violence. But there is an update to this article.
Good.
That these charges were dropped.
Good. Because I see shit like that all the time on these cars.
He's so That's proud funny. Of his I eat ass sticker.
But, like, I've seen so many inappropriate things.
So many
things that say fucking bitch and get off my ass. Or, like, the ones that say, like, if you're going to ride my ass, you might as well pull my hair. Like,
yeah.
They all indicate sexual things.
Oh, yeah. This was just, like, a cop who didn't find it funny.
Yeah.
He was just trying to be a dick. But, yeah, I thought that would be a good way to end this very serious topic still. Because, like, even though they survived, it still feels, like, very serious. Because what happened was just fucking tragic.
Definitely. And also taking a second to commemorate. Yeah. Both of, like, them and how strong and badass that they were.
Yeah.
That they knew what to do and fucking lived through it.
Yeah, because when you're in that situation, like, no matter how often you think about it, you don't know how you're going to react.
I know.
Which...
like, when I walk at night, like, to the dumpster and stuff, I'm like, yeah. Okay, I have my phone. If someone tries to pull me in this van that's pulling up, I'm going to make sure that I, like, drop my shoe and I'm going to leave my spit in their car and I'm going to do this and that and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I know, like, if it ever to happen, I would just start sobbing and that would be my only reaction.
Oh, immediately. I would be like those stories that you see where it's like, little boy released after singing hymns for 3 hours. But I would just be like,
what? What's going on?
So many times we're just like, shut the fuck up and like drop kick me out of the back of the van.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Or you just start singing musical theater.
Oh yeah,
that as would be loud good. As you can.
Here is Hamilton, Act One.
From beginning to end.
Dun 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 dun. That's so fucked up. That wouldn't happen.
Honestly. I can just imagine us having one full, like, bonus episode of us just singing as much as Hamilton as possible without fucking up.
I feel like that would be a copyright infringement.
Oh, 100%.
Maybe that's just something we do for ourselves.
Got it.
Ew. I don't know what we're doing with it, with the wink and the...
I'm sorry. I was just really excited.
But... we hope that you guys enjoyed this week's episode, something a little different, and be on the lookout for what we cover next week because it's going to be a crazy story.
Yeah, definitely not one of the like top three, but he's definitely a heavy hitter and it's pretty recent.
Yeah, it's like a heavy hitter that most people don't know is a heavy hitter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's exciting. We'll see you guys next week.
And remember to review and rate and yes. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook to see pictures and information regarding our cases that we cover.
Yes, ma'am.
Reach out to us at crimebinge@gmail.com if you want to suggest anything.
Yeah. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.